This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiya Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
22 countries have formally approached BRICS countries to become full members of BRICS. There's an equal number of countries that have been informally asking about becoming BRICS members.
That's South Africa's BRICS ambassador Anil Suklal on countries interested in becoming members of the group. Details coming up. Also, Kenyan police clashed with stone-throwing demonstrators in Nairobi for the third consecutive day. And the World Health Organization is urging action to prevent and control dengue. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. As Sudan's warring factions gear up for another round of talks in Jeddah, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF, says it is ready for long-term ceasefire negotiations to address the root causes of the conflict. Sudan Armed Forces delegation is back in Jeddah after accusing the RSF of violating previous ceasefires mediated by the United States and Saudi Arabia. RSF advisor Yusif Izzat disputes the claim and assures a strong joint monitoring mechanism this time around that will include neighboring countries. He tells VOA's Nabil Biagio the RSF aims for a comprehensive solution to Sudan's historical problems, which he says have produced numerous wars.
We are not looking for war. The war is not our favor. And we try to sit, and now we are talking about how to start to talk to them and how to start the negotiation for ceasefire and humanitarian issue. And then after that, we will go to the political negotiation or political solution.
The RSF has been talking about a comprehensive solution, like you just mentioned, and also the root causes of the conflict. What are the root causes of this conflict that you want to address in Jeddah?
Yeah, you know, as you know, the history of Sudan, since 1955, the war continuing. Like, there's a war in Sudan, and the whole world, they know that there's a war in Sudan, and there's the causes for that war. Why the Sudanese people attacked by SAF? Since the South Sudan issue, since the Darfur, Nuba Mountain, Blue Nile, East Sudan, and even in North. So this is continuing, and the people, they have demand. They want to be part of the power, like it's a power sharing. They want to be equal, their identity to be recognized as a Sudanese. Because, you know, as you know, there's some elites. Since the independence of the country, they're ruling this country the same way. They're like recycling themselves. Either a military government or democratic government is the same elite. So now is the time for all Sudanese to decide about their future, the country future. The whole Sudanese to be equal and the power to reflect the diversity of the Sudanese people, and also all the other institutions, including the army, reflect the Sudanese diversity in its command and in the high positions. And also, all the Sudanese want to see themselves as part of the power, as part of the decision of the Sudan. And then that's the root causes of the conflict. All the Sudanese fighting for that, for equality, justice, and identity recognition, development. And like all, that's the root causes of the war in Sudan.
Like you said, these are historical and big comprehensive issues cannot possibly be addressed in Jeddah and just between the RSF and the army. You would think that it would require all Sudanese to be part of it. But for now, people want the fighting to stop, the killing to stop.
Yeah.
They want. So.
Yeah.
Is it going to be different this time? Because last time we had a series of ceasefires, they were all violated. What is going to be different this time?
Actually, I agree with you. Like, negotiation between RSF and SAF is just to stop fighting and like to sign a long-term ceasefire that allows the civilians and politicians to come to the table, and all Sudanese representatives, those stakeholders, to come to the table, and we discuss the issue of the root causes of the conflict, and we try to find solution and define the state itself. Now, yes, the ceasefire we had like before is it's not success. Like succeeded because of this violation, and we try to solve that by a monitoring committee, and then we try to bring community monitoring committee to the ground, and now we're thinking for a center for ceasefire. That center is like with SAF, RSF, and other like the mediators, and maybe including some intelligence and armies, officers from some countries. And that's still, we discuss that, but we try to find the way that for the respect of the ceasefire.
That's Yusuf Izzat, advisor to Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces, speaking on WhatsApp call with VOA's Nabil Biagio. A team of 18 staffers working for Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, was violently assaulted by a group of armed men yesterday while transporting medical supplies in South Khartoum. Christopher Garnier, MSF's emergency manager for Sudan, who just left Eastern Chad a few weeks ago, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the attack put the group's activities in danger and it cannot continue working in the Sudanese capital if minimum safety guarantees are not met.
They were stopped by a drunk armed group and they were beaten and threatened, which is quite unacceptable for us and very concerning. So they received a few slaps or punches. No big enough for medical admission, but at least how can I express that? The fact that you can be beaten, even if it's not a big punch, is enough to insult someone. So it was quite a huge insult and physical aggression.
And this happened at the while they were transporting medical supplies, I understand, to the Turkish hospital in southern Khartoum?
Yes, absolutely. We are changing our warehouse. As you said, Khartoum is not very easy to drive in, so we try to minimize our movement. And we now have found a new warehouse that is closer from the hospital, and we were just moving from a place to another. And it was on the way back. All the road was agreed and was okay, and we didn't face any issues until this, that was something like 700 meters from the hospital, and some armed people get out of the house. Definitely they were drunk, and drunk people are never very smart.
You know, the last time we spoke to someone inside Sudan with the aid group, they were saying that only 20% of the hospitals and healthcare facilities in Khartoum and other cities like that are under attack were open. Is that still the case?
This is globally the case, yes. We are probably running one of the last opened hospitals in Khartoum. So for sure, our presence in Khartoum as MSF, I mean, we are the only international actor still remaining there. And our presence to be able to provide some health care to civilians there is very, very important.
This team of 18 people with MSF that was assaulted by these gunmen, do they know which side they were on, or do they even know if they were with one of the military groups that are fighting each other in Khartoum?
Not at all. I mean, those people, those armed people, were not clearly identified. So it's very difficult to say to who they belong, and even if they belong to anyone.
MSF is trying to do its work there. It's being prohibited from doing a lot of its work because of the fighting. What is your message to the Sudanese army and the soldiers or the forces that are with the rapid support forces?
That civilians and humanitarians shouldn't be involved in the conflict. We have absolutely no involvement by any type in the conflict, whatever the reason are behind. We are just here to support civilians who are in need of care. So, of course, our message is to be able to access and to be safe running our activity, our medical activity, and to be able to provide some health care in good condition. I mean, it's very difficult and very concerning. If we cannot access properly, if we cannot work properly in peace and in a safe environment. And so the message we want to send to everyone is just help us to help you or to help your people and to be able to provide our medical activities and to continue our medical activities.
That is Christopher Garnier, MSF's emergency manager for Sudan. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Paris. ¶¶ You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Today, Kenyan police clashed with stone-throwing demonstrators in a Nairobi slum for a third consecutive day, firing tear gas and rubber bullets amid mounting calls for dialogue between the government and the opposition. The French news agency AFP says in Nairobi's Kibera slum, an opposition stronghold, running battles erupted between police and protesters carrying rocks and crude weapons. Some demonstrators set fire to tires and used them as barricades. Opposition leader Raila Odinga called for 3 days of demonstrations in most of the country starting Wednesday. But schools and shops reopened yesterday, and the Interior Ministry said normalcy has returned to the country, save for a few cases of looting and breach of the peace by small bands of marauding lawbreakers. AFP says the violence has alarmed the Kenyans and the international community alike, with the Commonwealth Secretariat on Thursday joining calls for the two sides to hold talks. Odinga called off demonstrations in April and May after President William Ruto agreed to dialogue, but the talks broke down. In South Africa, opposition parties are pushing for former President Jacob Zuma to return to prison. This after the Constitutional Court confirmed that a decision to grant him medical parole was illegal. 81-year-old Zuma has been sentenced to 15 months in jail for contempt of court in 2021 for refusing to appear before a national inquiry on government corruption. But he served less than 2 months after the chief of correctional services, a friend of Zuma's, set him free. Darren Taylor has more from Johannesburg.
As arguments for and against Zuma's return to prison rage in South Africa, the former president remains in Russia. His spokesperson, Mzwanele Manyi, has told VOA that Zuma will stay in Moscow indefinitely as he receives medical treatment for what he calls a very serious condition.
I am not in a position to breach the doctor-patient confidentiality, no. There is no reason that he would have gone all the way to Russia just to go and enjoy the weather there. He has gone there because of health issues. He is going through various procedures with the medical people. They will say when it's time for him to come home.
Manyi says it's Zuma's right to get medical help wherever he wishes. South Africa's new prisons commissioner still has to decide whether the former president should go back to jail to serve the remainder of his sentence. Manyi says Zuma's been punished enough.
I think what perhaps South Africans and most people don't seem to appreciate is that when you're in parole, it's almost like you're an outdoor prisoner, but the prisoner you are. When President Zuma was in parole, you'll remember this, he was not able to even do his own press statements. It was a mission for him to even attend family funerals. He couldn't be in a gathering. It was almost like in apartheid times. If he had to leave the province, he had to report and all of that. Now, for people to deem that as freedom, I think it's madness.
But as constitutional law expert Pierre DeVos points out, Zuma openly violated the conditions of his parole, as he was often seen at social events. Yet DeVos doesn't believe it's necessary for the former president to return to his cell.
I think we are far too quick to want to send people to prison and keep them in prison in South Africa in cases where it won't really make a big difference. Will it make a difference? Will it send a signal that Mr. Zuma is not above the law if you send him to prison? Or will that not really help at all? And if he's released on correctional supervision and strict restrictions are imposed, would that not be sufficient?
DeVos expects Zuma to escape jail, at least for now. The former president still faces multiple court cases related to alleged corruption and other financial crimes stretching back to the 1990s. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The BRICS group of fast-developing economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, has always positioned itself as an alternative to the Western-dominated global order. BRICS officials say that spirit has attracted some 22 countries to join the bloc as South Africa gears up to host a meeting of the bloc in August. But some analysts question what the group has accomplished, as Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
Current BRICS chair, South Africa, is hosting the three-day summit in Johannesburg next month and says BRICS expansion will be high on the agenda. Argentina, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates are all among the countries looking to join the bloc, South Africa's BRICS ambassador, Anil Suklal, told journalists, adding that it demonstrated the confidence global South nations have in the organization.
22 countries have formally approached BRICS countries to become full members of BRICS. There's an equal number of countries that have been informally asking about becoming BRICS members.
BRICS is seen as a powerful force, said Suklal, who added that measured by purchasing power parity, it now accounts for 31.7% of global GDP, having overtaken the G7, a forum of advanced democracies that includes the US. But analysts differ in their assessment of what concrete achievements BRICS has made since its inception in 2009. This is Daniel Bradlow, a University of Pretoria professor who has studied the bloc.
The New Development Bank, which has done a substantial amount of lending, is the most prominent achievement. It's also led to some increased trade between the countries. It's won some international attention.
However, he said the group had a mixed record and it was yet to be seen whether its potential would be realized in the future. But Mika Takizo-Kubai, a researcher at the Institute for Global Dialogue at the University of South Africa, said he thought BRICS had achieved a fair amount, contrary to expectations.
You will recall that from the onset, BRICS was an outfit that was easily dismissed by many, particularly in the West, seen merely as some concept. It has achieved a lot in that in the 15 years that it's been around.
He points to the fact the bloc founded an international development finance institution, as well as how it's been looking at alternative ways of conducting trade and promoting local currencies as some of those achievements. However, Ali Khan Sachu, an economic analyst, says for a long time the body was indeed primarily conceptual in nature.
If we're looking for a silver bullet type thing that's come out of it so far, I don't think that's clear. But I think in the long run, what we're seeing is a serious pole develop, and the main issue is the increased multipolarity of the world, and I think BRICS continues to represent that.
Except for Russian President Vladimir Putin, who can't travel to South Africa because he's wanted by an international court for war crimes in Ukraine, all the BRICS heads of state will be attending the summit in person next month. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And in World Cup soccer news, Zambia's national women's soccer team will make its World Cup debut Saturday against Japan at the games in Australia and New Zealand. The national team's success has encouraged many young women to take up the sport. But Zambia's Football Association is also investigating allegations of sexual abuse by coaches on the team that tarnished its image. Katie Short reports from Lusaka, Zambia.
There was a thunderous welcome for the Zambian national women's soccer team, popularly known as the Copper Queens, on arrival in New Zealand for their maiden appearance at the Women's World Cup. It's a dream come true for the team, as the supporters all over Zambia and beyond are in a jubilant mood to support them. Most of the players on the team come from low-income households. The Copper Queens' success has inspired many girls to take up football in a country where the sport has been dominated by men for a long time. Barbara Banda, Zambia's national women's soccer team captain, says in a WhatsApp message to VOA from New Zealand on Thursday that her journey as a professional female footballer was not an easy one. The 23-year-old plays professional football for the Chinese team Shanghai Shengli. Banda was ruled out of last year's Women's Africa Cup of Nations after she failed a gender eligibility test due to high testosterone levels. She is Zambia's first female footballer to play at the professional level.
I started from an academy. It's called Galax. I used to play with the boys' team. I had some difficulties with my families and the parents because they really wanted me to concentrate much at school, but and they always tell me, no, you can't be playing football, it's for boys.
But the team's participation at the World Cup has been embroiled in controversy over alleged sexual abuse of female players by some coaches. According to recent British media reports, some players were quoted as saying that it's normal for coaches to demand for sexual favours from the players. Football Association of Zambia spokesperson Sydney Mungala told VOA Thursday that the allegations are not new and the association has dealt with them. Mungala adds that the matter has been submitted to the International Association Football Federation, FIFA, which also conducted independent investigations.
The Football Association of Zambia did indicate that they had conducted an internal inquiry. They had also handed over the matter to the police because some of the allegations were of a criminal nature. We just want the Zambian public to actually rally behind the team. This is a glorious moment for Zambia, and we are not going to allow anyone to spoil it.
Zambia is also one of the few countries implementing equal pay for both female and male players. The Zambia Union of Football and Allied Workers Union is working closely with the Football Association of Zambia to ensure fair working conditions and contracts for female footballers and wants all players unionized. Kazembe Chibale, the union spokesperson, told VOA Thursday that her union is promoting the female footballers' rights, including maternity protection.
The main objective of the collective bargaining agreement is to clearly define rules around working conditions to ensure that all terms of employment adhere to the same fair standard across the industry.
Like Chibale, Juliet Chibuta, executive director of the Zambia National Women's Lobby, a non-governmental organization that champions gender equality, says equal pay for both male and female players is non-negotiable.
Female footballers should be paid the same as the male counterparts because of the fact that the energy and also the training and also the pride that they bring to the country is the same that the males could bring if they went to the World Cup.
The Copper Queens are considered underdogs at the World Cup and are ranked 77 in the world by FIFA. But the team surprised Germany last week when they beat them 3-2 in an international friendly. 32 teams are competing in football's biggest prize and includes teams like England, the United States, Brazil, Ireland and Canada. Only 4 African teams are participating: Zambia, Morocco, Nigeria and South Africa. Kathy Short for VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
With just a few weeks left before the opening ceremonies, workers in Kinshasa are rushing to finish facilities ahead of the Francophone Games, the French-speaking equivalent of the Commonwealth. The French news agency AFP says some 3,000 athletes from about 30 countries are set to arrive in DRC Congo's capital over the next few days, ahead of the July 28th start. Painters, technicians, and other workers are rushing to prepare venues. Some participants have pulled out due to concerns over facilities and security. Rehearsals for the opening ceremony have begun in the Martyrs Stadium, and initial fears that the 10-day event will be called off appear to have abated. Originally scheduled for 2021, the games were postponed because of the COVID pandemic, then again last year because of the facilities were not ready.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sikus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.